Well, welcome. Today we're going to discuss frameworks, the creative building blocks that shape and bring meaning to our experience and to our world. They're the stories, images, thoughts, perceptions, or models that we overlay onto this. Just this here. This unbound and unformed reality that simply is. These frameworks really are what set us humans apart. Just consider what we'd be like without our stories or frames. We'd just be these tall, awkward, gangly things that don't do much of anything. We humans, we require stories to understand who we are and what our relation to each other is, as well as to the world. It's our stories that navigate us through the world. We're each little artists. We're model builders. We're meaning makers. So, just to give a little example, consider that we call today Thursday, but what's really underneath this label? I mean, what is Thursday really? Isn't it just a useful convention we've created so that we can relate and cooperate with one another? It's important that we know what Thursday means so that, you know, we can all make it here on time, right? But again, what is Thursday really? Another one of these creations, these concepts to consider is the Big Dipper. Is there really a Big Dipper up in the night sky? Or is there just a collection of stars that we've assigned this meaning to? And moreover, what is a star? Consider that every word or label or definition we've created is made entirely of other words, which in turn are made of other words, and round it goes. We even do this with our sense of self. Everything is made of entirely non-self elements. Just like a tree is made of soil, rain, and air, well, so too am I made entirely of non-John elements. Thoughts, feelings, emotions, sensations, my body. Again, we assign meaning to some small portion of the whole of reality. And we do this because it's useful for us to relate to one another and to navigate our lives and the world. So in this discussion I've recorded from our Thursday meeting, which I'll share in a moment, we'll explore how we can become more aware of the frames we're using so that we can recognize any unhelpful or harmful patterns that we're using. And then once we're aware of them, we can start to replace them with more loving, honest, beneficial, and skillful frames. Anyway, I really love the conversation, and I hope you do too.
Candace and River, you're one of the sharpest people I know with their words and their frames. So yeah, I'll actually speak to both of you, but Candace, you've also done work in the corporate world, helping people, boards, teams reframe their problems and working relations.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know. How about you start with maybe telling us some common unhelpful or hurtful frames you saw in your at the time in your corporate job?
Yeah. What immediately comes to mind is it's not necessarily, it'll be interesting to see what the different frames of reference, but like always getting to know, I would note when, for whatever lens they were looking through, lent itself to thinking that someone or something external to them, mostly someone, if I was working with somebody and they felt that somebody that they were working with and they would regard them negatively, so that negative regard would be an indicator to me of their viewing a situation or a person through some kind of framework, some kind of story, some kind of lens that is going to justify their belief that Jeff is an idiot, you know, in the workspace. And so whatever, and I think when I would work with those people, sometimes it was helpful to get a little bit of the story, but I would often listen to why they think so-and-so is out to get their project or a mustache twirling villain, you know, whatever story the brain wants to put onto it. And then I would encourage what I called unconditional positive regard. I'd posit it like a question. I'd be like, hey, like, have you ever heard of unconditional positive regard? And, you know, of course, no one in the business space has like heard those words before, because really what I did was take this idea of metta, of loving kindness, and put it into business speak. And what really I would see would light people up is this aha moment when I would mention that, like, whenever I start to regard someone negatively, I hinder my ability to work with them moving forward. Like, even if they were, for some justifiable reason, whatever the lens or story is, like an awful person, my choice to regard them negatively is going to hinder progress. It has nothing to do with them. And so that would be like that kind of positive negative posture or orientation towards a particular person or a thing in projects, especially if there was some kind of unforeseen circumstance, which there always is with projects. We make a plan, we start to execute the plan, and then, oh, look, like things we didn't anticipate occur. Depending on people's paradigms about who they are, paradigms about who they believe their team to be, would always create how they responded as a group to the plot twist. And sometimes they would struggle because they had more of a, it didn't go to according to plan, I suck kind of orientation. That, like, so I find myself often honing in on, of all the frameworks an individual has, I'm most interested with my project teams and in that business space, I'm most interested in finding out how they feel about themselves. Because even if the chief operating officer is a genius, if he's feeling low about himself in that day, then or in life in general, then he's going to feel low or negative about the stuff that's happening outside of him. I don't know, but
yeah, oh, that totally hits. Yeah, a few things there I'd like to pick up on, but I'll start with your most recent comment. Yes, I think it's so important that we have to begin at home. How are we holding ourselves? You know, because how we do that bleeds out into everything, because we are only what we are in relation to or with, you know, the world is our mirror. That's us. So yeah, you got to start at home, and finding that self-love is, man, every day, extend a little in the morning, a little at night. The other thing that really hit with me was the justification. That when we set up these frameworks, we do get into this habit of justifying it everywhere, right? But
the justification part, I think it's because they begin to identify with the framework. Because then, when identity climbs onto a particular form, a framework of thought or belief or experience of the world, then I need to defend my position to maintain my identity. Like, it becomes something that the ego is slowly.
Yes.
And so versatility of frameworks is always something that's really fun for me to see in other people, where I'm like, oh, your identity is not attached to this particular Yeah. And so justification or defense is always an interesting indicator of something to, for me to kind of note in myself, especially if I'm feeling like, oh, I'm attacked because this person doesn't believe what I believe. Then I get to be like, oh, why do I feel attacked? Why do I feel like I need to defend? Am I over-identifying with a particular form of self? And does that identification serve me right now? I get to look at that in myself, but then try to encourage that introspection in others.
Head on. Yeah, there's usually ego there that's trying to stand its ground. Which brings me back to the, I said, there's an exception to viewing everything from experience. And that's, I kind of, in all of these discussions in this space, Project Human, I want to continually bring us back to this non-dual presence. And, you know, so we have this relational world, this world of frames and stories and beliefs. And, but there is this space prior to the stories, the context of these stories. And it's pre-verbal, it's pre-seen, it's no thing, but yeah, kind of this open space. And so, yeah, we have to wear certain egos or put on certain hats to show up in the world as a mother, as a coworker, as whatever. Mm-hmm. And we want to do that as consciously as we can through our framing and storytelling. But at the same time, we need to keep one hand in or one foot in this ultimate reality. You know, this. So when there is some kind of, frustration or defense occurring, yeah, are you occupying that open space? Mm-hmm. And you hold this framework lightly. Could you be wrong about something? Yeah, turn inward, like you said.
Yeah, I love that. I would love to hear your thoughts, your guys' thoughts too, on how to because the no space, that space of formlessness. Like, I find that my mind, of course, loves to identify patterns and forms. And so I can feel it being like, okay, when I need to step back and be in no space, like, how do I do that? How do I catch myself and do that in the moment, I suppose? Love to hear.
Right. Skillful means or tools.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk about those. But can we first just kind of let River have her piece on frames? Because I'd love to get her perspective. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, everything that you both said, the way that it kind of dictates and informs our life, our belief systems, and then in turn, our actual experience, like our perception becomes our reality. And as we identify with it, yeah, that's where we fall into those pitfalls. But I love that we're having this conversation with Candace having 30 different kinds of frames right behind you. And frames are so important because they inform the thing, but they are not the thing. And to know that and to like be able to separate that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a huge part of the humility, is to understand that we're not, when we put a frame around something, we are not experiencing that thing. We are experiencing the condition of the frame around it. The condition of the frame around it also decides how we see it, what is cropped out, what is experienced in it. And so it's that kind of like from my poem, Binding the Boundless, like we do bind experience with these frames or with these labels.
Can you see
that poem to share?
God said, let there be. And there was, and it was, and we are fumbling through an infinity, pointing our fingers and reaching the tips of our tongues to taste the souls of those that be and they that were and it that was and we that are, binding the boundless with our teeth and tongue and song, at once knowing and yet blinding ourselves to the unknown.
Mm-hmm. See what I mean? Very skillful at building frames, creating frames.
Well, and I think that speaks to that duality that we're meant to carry and that yeah. humility that we've talked about as well. It's like the moment we name something, the moment we bind it, is the moment that we admit that we don't actually know it.
Yeah. Mm. We've lost our grasp of reality by grasping.
You know what I love too about that how astute observation the pictures and the frames in the background is, my mind keeps playing with the question of like, can you imagine if I had the same frame of the same picture over and over again on the wall behind me? Like, who has a gallery wall like that? And there are some, you know, some art that people put up in their homes that is framed, but I think my mind is going to be chewing on the lessons learned from getting to explore that of like, well, this wall would be so boring, you know, if it was the same frame, same picture. And for me, like, and I, again, honoring the multiplicity of paths, like, I do think that there, my feeling is that there are individuals who get to experience this life with one frame and they get to look through it through that frame. And then there are individuals who get to look through it from multiple frames. And it just depends on what their inner knowing, their intuition, their soul wants. And none of them are less valuable than the other. Like, if my mom, who is going to stay in a Christian paradigm, and thrives in it and feels connected and feels seen and feels whole and loved by the God that she knows in the form that she knows him in, if that's the life that she gets to lead, comparative to her daughter who gets to like look through multiple frameworks and gets to know God in multiple forms, both inside, outside, both of those are equally valuable to me. And one is not less than the other, especially if it's contributing to what, you know, feeling loved. And so I like that too of like, I wonder what kind of frames we all have on our gallery walls inside our hearts.
Yeah. And no two of us can have the exact same frame, right? I mean, each of us and our experience, our genetic makeup, all of it is unique. Mm-hmm. We are only us and our experience is only ours in a way.
Can I ask a question? Candace, how do you...
Wait, can I continue on my thread? Because that was just kind of an introduction, but it might speak to what you might press her on for ask. And yes, so I agree in having multiple frameworks. And even for an individual, one frame may not be useful at that particular moment in their lives or time of day even, you know, right. And this other frame might do the trick. Now, and yes, some people can use the framework of Christianity to find this non-dual presence, even, you know, the mysticism is there. And that's true for so many different paths, but I don't think I take as much of an instrumentalist approach as you do. I think there's still truth, meaning that some frameworks we can see or criticize or, I don't know, examine, you know, use reason, apply critical pressure to see if they are more harmful than others, right? Mm-hmm. Like, is the belief in jihad a useful frame for anyone? Mm-hmm. You know, I may want to challenge that belief, but I don't know what your response is to that, or if River, I spoke to anything that was hitting there for you and you want to add or piggyback on that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the question was just, how do you hold that while not sliding into like the apathy that comes with moral relativity?
The apathy that comes with moral relativity?
Yeah, I mean, to hold that like there are no wrong frameworks or that everyone is where they are supposed to be. There can come this idea that, oh, well, I don't need to speak out against that, or I don't need to fight for that, or I don't need to, because they're just, it's their moral table, or it's their moral thing to figure out, right?
Yeah, I can speak to that in terms of like personal, like where my personal experiences have been. I think it's very easy in these types of discussions for people to get into hypotheticals of like, let's build a thought experiment or a hypothetical of this. For example, and not that it was a hypothetical, John, but the example of jihad, I am not directly called into experience of that paradigm with someone. And so I can't speak to what would I do? How would I show up if I was sitting across from another human and they had that paradigm and that paradigm was informing their behavior in a negative way that impacted the world? And I know that for what I'm feeling for myself right now is that I could address what is in my present moment in front of me. And so when I come across somebody that might be doing harm through their belief system. How I've shown up in those moments is really interesting. I think I mentioned to you guys when Timothy and I were visiting that there was a moment we were walking in Hawaii and a woman who lives down the street, very angry at anyone who is not a native to the island, pulls up in her truck and rolls down the window. We were prepared to just let her pass. And just starts railing on Tim and telling me what a terrible human he is, that he lets his kids play in the road, just all kinds of whatever her frameworks. It wasn't as extreme as like jihad or anything like that. But to watch it all unfold at us and then to meet it in the way that I did, I was even surprised where I like just held eye contact and had this open-hearted spaciousness. That none of it really stuck. And as soon as she had said her piece, I asked her name. It was Dolly. I said, well, Dolly, thank you for sharing your thoughts with me. I hope you have a great day. And the exchange was so bizarre to her that she said, I hope you have a great day too. And then like, the energy of her anger still kind of lingered with Timothy and I, and we got to hold space for that and work through it. There's this idea too, I think, that sometimes we think that if one has got moral relativity, then they're not apt to fight for the world. Or that we also think that we get to go fight a fight that's possibly not mine. There is a lot of really challenging, dense stuff happening in the world right now. And I get to hold space for the humans that come into my orbit that are impacted by it. I don't know, for me right now, like I just haven't been called into any of those direct extreme fights. So I can't speak what I would do in those situations. Even imagine.
I have a similar experience. So after I had meditated, done a 30-day retreat in Thailand, I was at a little restaurant in just off a beach somewhere, and this, you know, I had this little strip of shops and restaurants and bars, whatever, and I'm kind of at the edge of this strip in one of these restaurants, and there's this big guy walking through the strip and just looking to fight with anyone and everyone, and all the stores have refused to serve him or to let him get drinks or anything. And anyway, I'm standing there and I'm like a pretty fit guy. And he looks at me and just like, yep, I'm going to come fight you. You know, with these eyes of death. But my heart was in such an open space. He came over and I just reached my hand out and put it on his heart. And he just dropped everything. And in kind of choppy English said, you're a good guy, and walked away. So, yes, I think our presence speaks so loudly, right? And if you can start from the heart, you, of course, always start there. Where it starts to get tricky is when we have these kind of seemingly points of disconnection. So as citizens, we have to vote for representatives. Our representatives are dealing with, you know, national and international policies and stuff. And we are participants in this world and want to be informed citizens, you know, Democrats. And so I don't know. Sometimes it's, we almost need to have that disconnected. And again, it's not really disconnected in the end. You can still reach from your deepest intention of love, but look at a situation like what's happening in the Middle East, or like what's happening in Russia and Ukraine, or, you know, China, Taiwan, all of these places. And I think it's almost necessary to act, if we're going to act compassionately, right? Compassion is a verb. So we got to inform ourselves and make a decision what is going to create the least amount of harm or the most harmony on this earth, and act accordingly. That goes into climate change and a number of other things, you know. So yeah, I don't know, frameworks. If I believe the climate change isn't real because it snowed in my yard that day, you know, that's a frame that I think we should challenge.
And that's the, that's like the part of this conversation where I feel like it is what you are going to do in that moment when that framework comes up. Inside of you, you meet this person and you are aware enough of yourself in the situation to say, hey, can we take a look at this? Is this real? Is this true? How is this impacting our behavior? And like getting to have that conversation in that unique circumstance and moment as it's unfolded in your present. And that, like, when I'm always curious about, and maybe getting an opportunity to become aware of, when we talk about what will we do out of the present moment, it's like, what will I do if this occurs? I can have some idea, but also it's still a projection, a guess.
Totally.
And so I've thought of there was a quote, the one that says something like, it's like paraphrasing Ram Dass. Have you guys heard this quote where it says to paraphrase Ram Dass? Let me think. Whether it's the first day of the apocalypse or the first day of the golden age, the work remains the same: to love each other and to ease the suffering as much as possible. And that feels good to me in regards to every situation I come across. Is if I feel called to go have direct action, go to the Middle East, and
or just vote.
Action, or just vote, or
yeah,
or more often than not, I'll tell you what happens in my direct experience right now. I am invited to sit down and send metta bhavana, specifically in that direction. And I have a paradigm or a framework right now that believes that has a direct unseen impact. It's not the only thing that I do, but I also know that the cultivation of loving kindness and sending that intention through the unseen frameworks has an impact.
Yeah, so, agreed.
Yeah.
Agreed. Yeah. So speaking of, why don't we move into some skillful means? I mean, that's one right there, right? Talk about your current relationship with metta practice.
It is my favorite right now. There's so just that, because for me it's so simple, being able to tune into my breath and then to call forward an idea, a person, a situation, and to hold it in my mind's eye and my heart and say, may you be well, may you be happy, may you be peaceful, and to truly mean it from my heart space. And I don't know. It gets into kind of a wordless landscape for me where I don't know how to describe what it feels like to go deeper and deeper into that practice and to be able to just, as much as possible, in my mind and my heart first, which makes me feel brave. It makes me feel like I can show up with love and compassion when I am checking off marks on the ballot or when I am in front of somebody who has extreme political paradigms that might impact the behavior towards others. Yeah. You know,
expansive, at ease.
Yeah.
And stability.
And it's just such a simple practice. It's just that.
Yeah. And it's so crucial because, you know, as we move through life, we kind of unconsciously pick up all of these frames and they're deeply rooted in there. And so it's not just, ooh, right, learn this new thing, or yeah, I'm going to choose to love everyone and boom, we're there. Mm-hmm. It is experiential practice. So yeah, we over time can cultivate it and grow this feeling of love that's in us, and it becomes a part of who we are and how we show up in the world. I mean, it is at bottom the core of our being. And so yeah, I really like that relational way. And like you said, not just repeating it dry, though that may happen sometimes, you know, there's times where it feels contrived, but we keep doing it to prep the soil for that metta to show up. But yeah, it's really important that it's not just the frame that we cultivate, but it's also the lived attitude or the posture, which, you know, with your story with this woman in Hawaii, you know, that's what she felt. And this unconditional good regard.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you call it?
Unconditional positive regard.
Positive regard.
That's the business speak.
Yeah.
So, you know, it happened again too, the first time I felt the surprise at how I was able to show up in a situation because of the choice to practice this loving kindness cultivation. It happened it's been about, I want to say a year ago, someone stole my car,
right.
My green Kia Soul, you know, and I remember going through the day of just, you know, talking to the police in one district, talking to the police in the other district, getting the car towed, and it went from 9 a.m. all the way until about 8 p.m. before we were done dealing with that. The outcome of somebody taking something that wasn't theirs and just having a party and then trashing the car. And I remember I was driving home with my roommate, was gracious and had chauffeured me everywhere that day. And I could feel the low, the tired in my emotions. And she reflected or asked how I was feeling. And I remember what came out of my mouth even surprised me, because I said, you know, like, I can see how I could choose in this moment to just be very pissed off at this person. That through the witnesses and stuff, we knew that it was a man and that they'd seen him, but they thought that he was a friend or something. And so they didn't report when they witnessed this person rummaging around in my car before he stole it. I remember sitting in the driver's seat and then reflecting to my friend, like, I could be mad at this person. It would be totally justified. Like, the car's gone. I don't know what I'm going to do. I was like, but what I feel right now is, and I just started crying. Like, and it wasn't like sad cry. It was a bliss cry. Like, there were tears of bliss coming out of my eyes and this like warmth that was just shooting out of the center of my heart. That's the best I can, even describing the situation. Now I can feel it in this space. And I felt like, that it was so important to just send this person loving kindness. I wondered to myself how many people he may have taken from and something, and that how as a result, those people, which is completely understandable, just send like this pissed off energy right back at this at him. But the natural inclination in that moment, it wasn't a default to an older approach where I would have been like,
right.
It was just this, I love this human, and I don't know who or what his life has been like that has taught him to do this over and over again. But I hope that by just being loving and forgiving, that somehow this will also, even though I'll never meet him, change the trajectory of his life, that I'm going to wish him well anyways. And that takes a lot of bravery, I think, too, and a lot of vulnerability to show up in the world and say, I love you. I'm not afraid. Do your worst. You can not. And I don't mean that in the terms of like, don't have boundaries, but there are moments where I feel called to show up and say, I'm not afraid. I love you. And that means you might rail at me a little bit, and that's okay.
Yeah.
That story reminded me of an experience I had and then shared with River, which really opened her up. So I was on a retreat with Locke Kelly, a non-dual meditation teacher and psychotherapist. And his wife, Paige Kelly, an amazing psychotherapist herself, did a internal family systems like live model. So she asked me earlier in the day, hey, John, would you mind being the person that emulates this for everyone? And I was kind of shy, shy member of my family came in there. And I said, you know, I maybe ask some others. I see a shy part here, but if you don't bite anyone, yeah, I'm happy to do it. Blah, blah, blah. I told her later, you know, I'll do it. And so she said, okay, just, I don't want you to think about it. I want this to be spontaneous, but I'm going to ask for a part to arise in this, and I'll see what bubbles up. So in the few hours before it happened, I had doubt that was kind of arising, and I had, I can't remember what the beginning of emotion was. Fear. And I thought I was going to do the doubt, explore the doubt, because I was in a space with my work that's like, you know, nothing's ever good enough. You're not going to make it. You're going to fail. And so, yeah, that was like heavy on my mind, had been, and, you know, so. Anyway, I get up there and it turns out the fear arises. And so anyway, how this works is she says, I say, oh, I feel fear here with me. And so she actually has me assign someone in the audience to play fear. So you can see the physical representation of it. And so I pick a person. And again, she says, just be intuitive about who you pick. And you just pick and they come up. They can say no if they want, but. So I have fear up here with me, and now we can have a discussion with fear. It's like, hey, fear, what's going on? Is there anything you need to tell me right now? Is there, you know, do you need some space? Whatever. And, you know, you start this conversation with fear. And fear brings up another part, and you start talking to this part. And so you get this big collection of your parts, your family members on display. And turns out the fear pointed me to my sexual abuse from when I was a kid. And so she had me assign the person, I wanted to say abuser, and I'm like, but that's not right. I don't feel good about that. I don't know what you want to call him. Like, we'll just use the person's name, Ben. Sorry, Ben. But she asked, what would you like to tell this part? And it was just this coming out of my heart, like you expressed, this stream of compassion. Just, oh, my sweetheart, too. Sorry. But, yeah, it was like, I'm sorry for what happened to you, you know? Like, what was your experience growing up? You know, who hurt you? And so then Paige asked me if I wanted to bring up their abuser. Sure. Oh, and she did this beautiful thing where she used love, this all-encompassing concept, non-duality, or however you want to frame it. This thing that is at all of our backs. She had someone come up and put their hand on. These girls' backs. So powerful. Anyway, so she asks, if I want their abuser to come up. I'm like, sure. And is there anything you want to ask this person or say to this person? Or, and yeah, I kind of said, I wish I could have sat down with you, got to know you, to understand you. Because there seemed to be a little less access to that meta. But anyway, I came home and I told River this experience, and I don't know if River, you want to pick up from here.
The timing of it was really beautiful because the week before I had had a nightmare about sexual abuse, and I could not figure out exactly why I had had it or what I was supposed to take from it. In the dream, I had left Annalise and Olivia in a church to be babysat. And when I came back to pick them up, I came back and there was a man in the act of sexually assaulting Olivia. And it was a very graphic dream. And I was so mad. Immediately in my dream, I pulled out both my cell phone to call 911 and my knife out of my pocket. And I remember that I was going to stab a human. That was in my body. That whole feeling was, I knew that I could have stabbed that man without a doubt in my mind. And so coming away from that dream, I was like, why would my brain give me that? Why would I have to see that image of my daughter? Why would I have to experience that kind of rage? And so he came home from this retreat and he told me this story. And I had never revealed who had abused me as a child. But my abuser was also a teenager.
To anyone.
To anyone. So I had never told anyone. And part of the reason I had never told anyone was because I wanted to protect the girl who had done that to me, the teenage girl, because it was very obvious that this was not her, but a learned behavior. And I had all of the compassion in the world for her, but whomever did that to her, and she has no memories of her childhood at all, not good memories or bad memories, just no memories. And so I realized in my dream that the man represented not my abuser, but her abuser. And I was finally just able, because John shared all of that love and compassion for the teenage girls who had done that to him, it was like, oh, okay, I have a safe place now. I can tell this to John and we can sit in this and still hold all of the love for this human without blame. And it still is hard to look at that second degree level of the adult who would have perpetrated that against this girl, but yeah, just that level of compassion to be able to open that just kind of unwound so much in me.
Well, bringing up IFS or internal family systems, I think it is a great tool for working with frameworks, especially with yourself. So yeah, if you're unfamiliar with it, Dick Schwartz is the creator of it, but it allows you to really embody this non-dual presence, to step into this love center or self leadership, capital S self leadership, and to work from there, you know, with this unconditional love toward each of your parts and thinking of them more as pieces that are trying to help you and, you know, nurture you and defend you and take care of you. But now they're not isolated and alone. They have love at their back. So yeah, great, because it incorporates metta and this non-dual kind of presence. So another skillful means, I think at the beginning you said you wanted to know particularly of tools to help you step out of the relative mode when the thinker's really busy. It's like, how do I get back to my body or to, you know, this more open, spacious awareness? And yeah, I think there's a few ways, but one cool little tricky shortcut that I've found useful, and there's many variations of this in Zen and Mahamudra and Dzogchen, but this particular one, again, comes from Locke Kelly. And it's just, you know, maybe take a few deep breaths, kind of relaxing the nervous system, because we all know when the nervous system is excited, it's hard to do anything. But when we're in a more flow, open state, you know, whether it's sports, writing, art, yeah, it's much more easeful, creative, joyful. So yeah, just relax by, I don't know, taking a few deep breaths or whatever works for you. And then a simple inquiry: what is here now when there's no problem to solve? So we're kind of acknowledging this ego function, the problem solver that takes care of us all day, you know, that does our jobs. And yeah, it's really useful. We love this little part of ourselves. So it's like, hey, friend, my dear, my love, thank you so much for taking care of us today. I love you, and you know, right now, we're okay. And can we just take some space? And so kind of just allow that awareness that is inherent in thinking to just kind of step outside of the cloud of the mind. And yeah, and we can ask, what's here now when there's no problem to solve? Again, just allowing that ego function, problem solver, to just semi-retire or be a part of the bigger team.
So is that what you were asking, Candace? Or were you asking more of like, how do I get to the point where I can get to the point where I can breathe? Like, is it the initial waking up, or is it the after you've kind of like woken up to it? What? Sorry, does that make sense?
No, it does make sense. And I appreciate the clarifying question. You know, I'm not sure of my original intent. Like, I remember when I originally asked that question, like just being like, oh man, I wonder if it's also a little bit egoic of me to be like, how can I get there faster? You know?
The spiritual race.
Yeah, which is, you know, honoring, like, if I do catch myself stuck in a paradigm that I've identified with or that I'm defending, to learn to breathe and how take a step back and honor that as it shows up as well, rather than judge myself for being god damn it, like I but I'm grateful for the reminder. I did I haven't read all of Locke Kelly's book, but when you were first exploring him, John, I downloaded Locke Kelly's Audible, and I happened to be in my office at WGU, senior project manager in the office of the president. You're doing nothing but solving problems all day. And I'm get to that part in the book where he actually leads through that chat, that mindfulness practice of there's no problem to solve here. And I remember that as soon as my problem solver heard those words, that I started crying. Like it, whereas like, what a stark contrast to experience a moment of no problems to solve in an office space where I had been solving problems for 13 years. You know, and so, and it was such a beautiful moment. So like the callback to that, I think is definitely what I needed to hear of like, I'm noting a pattern too of that, of a repeat from a poem that recently really resonated with me about how we think we have thousands of serious moves. And there's no problem to solve. I don't have thousands of serious moves. Just surrender, right. Continually tripping over joy. So yes, thank you for the clarifying question, River. And yes, wherever we ended up is exactly what I needed to hear tonight. I appreciate that.
Nice. And your response kind of just went back to your earlier point about instead of getting in some hypothetical or whatever, just responding to what's here in front of us. Okay, maybe one more frame and then we can call it unless either of you would like to add anything. But one that I see everywhere and that I also see creates tremendous harm unconsciously is the comparing mind.
Yeah.
We're continually pitting things against each other and people against each other. Or we ask, what's your favorite? What's the best? What's better? And it's all of a sudden you've created this hierarchy and like, well, no, let's just talk about the thing itself. It bleeds into our language and the way we think. And so, I don't know, we can even then end up looking at like our kids and it's like, well, I like this one better than that one. It's like, we don't want to go down that terrain. Like, listen, I get it. If you're going on a trek and you need some good boots and you need to compare some models and get some reviews, but we overuse the comparing mind. More often than not, it is entirely unnecessary and, in fact, unhealthy. I don't know if either of you wants to piggyback or have another skillful means before we...
Yeah, comparison is the thief of joy, right? And it always comes down to that. And I think that a big part of the stories that we have about ourselves come down to comparison mind when we put ourselves next to other people and their accomplishments it's anytime we put ourselves against somebody's accomplishments positively or negatively, we're feeding the ego. We're feeding it both ways, right? And so, Don't do it.
Yeah. I mean, for my own experience, as I grow and expand into new frameworks and paradigms, some that I've just never been in before. And so it's completely and wholly unknown. So my body, my heart, my mind, my spirit are experiencing things that I have no reference point for. And so in those moments of like, holy hell, this is an unknown, completely new, exhilarating experience, I find that is often for me the trigger that puts my mind into comparative thinking. It used to be comparative thinking to feed that kind of egoic space or to deal with worthiness wounds. And now I can see that my mind tries to use that as a tool to gain some kind of foothold for what I'm going through. And it's the same practice that we've already talked about. I've become aware of it. And then I get to put a hand on my forehead and say, oh, baby, mind, I know you have no reference point for what we're experiencing. So you're searching comparatively for what other people might have something similar. I love you for that. It's not going to help. So let's just be present and feel this without any reference point. And then it becomes a reference point internally of itself. So I've learned to have, at least for myself, a little bit of compassion when I get into comparative mode. or to encourage those around me when they get into comparative mode. Cause for like, I've been noting like the roots under it, like the really sweet woman who was up at the Vipassana Center kept asking people how many sits have you done? How long have you done it? Anybody who'd done more than two, she'd be like, oh my gosh, you're extraordinary. And I'm just a Buddha baby, like incredibly comparative. But underneath that, it was very easy to feel and see that there was a worthiness wound there that was feeding the comparative. And so it almost seems, I'm sorry, my brain is on a roll now with this connection, that comparative thinking often might be symptomatic of a root of worth. And then for me, in my own experience of, holy hell, we're at the edges of my experience. I have no data set for this. Can somebody tell me about their experience so I can find a comparative foothold? But then that sets off suffering in my part, because what I'm experiencing, however similar to what somebody else experienced, doesn't help. It doesn't really.
Totally.
Anyways, but yeah, it was a... Oh, go ahead. I'll pause there. Does anybody have
phone? No. If you have things to say, you go. I do have things to say, but...
Yeah, first. Say things.
Here, go ahead.
Okay. So I think it's not only symptomatic, but it's cyclical in our culture, because I don't know a time in my life where I wasn't compared. Like, some of my earliest memories are being compared to my siblings, like, especially because I had eight older than me. We'd walk into a space and it would be like, either you're just like your sisters or you're nothing like your sisters. And it was, and so like that comparing, it's like, I don't know when that doesn't happen to a child. Like, and I see it with our kids too. Like, from the minute they were born, people are automatically handing them these stories, these comparing stories. And so it just becomes, it can become this like self-feeding cycle.
Mm.
Yeah, I like what you said about this tool you use to just say, oh, sweetheart, I know you want to have some measure for this. Let's just be here with it. Yeah, I think that's a great tool. Also, you made a comment about, and I don't know if this was exactly what you said, but it's similar in spiritual circles. When we set out on the spiritual path, we can really easily fall into that comparing mind, and we have some peak spiritual experience or something, and then the rest of our practice is like chasing that peak thing. Mm-hmm. And it's like, no, just right here, right now is it, baby. But yeah, I think that's important to keep our eyes on, especially as we're moving through our spiritual practices. You know, are we feeding the spiritual ego by making some race out of it or some, I don't know, yeah, kind of comparison. But then you mentioned also that there's typically a deeper root, right? And you acknowledged work. And, you know, I've found something similar, but I generally attribute the root to fear at bottom. And I mean, I guess, you know, we can be, that fear can be nuanced to lots of things. Fear of rejection or of unworthiness or whatever. But yeah, I found all of that powerful. So thanks for sharing.
Thank you. And I would love to circle back on the Rib's observations about the cyclical nature and almost like the heavy application of comparative thinking in the beginning of a human life cycle, or maybe some of these like areas of consciousness. It's kind of like one of those things where I'm like, oh yeah, like I was one of seven. And so it seems like the comparative mind is very prevalent at a certain part of our existence. And then we somehow, I don't know what your guys' journey is. I'm going to probably scribble about it later and be like, where and when did I step out of heavily using the comparative mind, both from the program that I may have learned it from my family culture, and both in terms of just referencing where I stand in the world. I'm wondering, I'm like, why is it so cyclical and so prevalent? And is it maybe because for me, it was a box that I got to explore myself in and then move beyond?
I definitely see it as a tool, and we can still utilize it as a tool, right? There are still people that when I compare myself to them, I look at them and I say, I want to be like them, you know, and that comparison is helpful to me because it's like, oh, this is a stepping stone, and being able to embody the things that I see in them is helpful to me. And so that comparing mind is a tool. It's just, it's also when overused or over-identified.
Yeah.
It's
but that's that also, again. Yeah, that's also like what you highlighted there over to me indicates like, it's an indicator of, or a really good indicator of where you might be on your self-love journey too, because we're talking about frameworks, right? So if I am in a framework where I see something, I compare and I feel jealous, then there are roots under there of I'm not enough, or I'm not worthy of that thing that other person has. Therefore, like the energy of the comparative thinking has this output of a jealousy that I get to look at. And then versus like, I've met people who they might see the same thing. They drive up and this person's driving the sports car that they want. And instead of going, for some reason, instead of going into jealousy, they go into aspiration. Like what the comparative model came up, but two different results. And what were the circumstances underneath those results that led to empowered aspiration? That's the car I want. I'm so glad it drove by me because it's inspiring me, reminding me that I get to work for things like that versus that's the car I want. That sucks. They have it. I don't. Like what happens there? It's the comparative thinking, but yeah. I don't know if you guys have insight.
Well, one of the things that you asked, sorry, John.
There you go.
One of the things that you asked, like when did that stop as much? And I can tell you, when I stopped going to church and when I stopped hanging out with my family as much, like those were huge. And obviously, like there are increments of that throughout my entire life because you just don't go from 0 to 100. Right. But my ability to note it and to see how prevalent it was in my life only came about in the absence of those environments. And in the absence of those environments, I really was able to see what was for me and what was for other people. And so much of that being for other people came from that comparing mind.
There's a lot to respond to. I'm not sure I can grab them all, but something sitting heavily with me is, well, Larry, first, let me acknowledge your point, River, that, comparison is useful. So I'll say right now and come back to this, it's useful, but maybe not skillful. So like when people were identifying you, it's like, oh, I have a reference point. She's part of the Haim family. She's either like them. Now I kind of have an idea of what to expect or whatever, versus, oh, okay, maybe she's a wild card, whatever. They're building some model that's useful for them navigating their experience with you or whatever. So a frame I really love from the Buddha, we don't just stop at useful, right? He has really four things that we always want to look at when we're proposing some kind of frame, when we're responding spontaneously in a moment. Consider, is this lovely? Is this useful? Or beneficial? Is this honest? And is this skillful? Because, right, we may hit three of those marks, but in the end, it's like, oh, actually, no, we could have sharpened this up because we said something that was honest. It came from a place of love. We were trying to give them a reflection that would maybe uplift their life. But maybe we didn't say it in the right setting or the right context. You know, maybe we said it at a dinner party and we should have told them privately. We should have done it more skillfully. But yeah, so I think those four questions when we're trying to work through frame with a conversation with a friend or whatever, even a friend internally, it's kind of just examine those. But anyway.
That examination, I think, comes with the accumulation of self-awareness over time. And then be self-aware enough to forgive myself for the moments that I wasn't, didn't have the skill level yet. And that I'm thinking in particular, there's a journal I have that's downstairs in a bin from when I was like 11. And I learned about Venn diagrams, and I wrote the worst Venn diagram about my sister and cows. Like, it was so mean. And I remember for the longest time, like, I felt the part of me that loves my sister and knows that she is an extraordinary expression of being, looks back at like 11-year-old me, and for a while felt some horror that I ever thought or felt that way. But then getting to be like, okay, where was my mind? What was my, like, and then to... Yeah, know that they, like, thank goodness for any kind of mindfulness practice, whatever system it comes from, Zen, Buddhist, any one of them, like,
yeah, more awareness is like, great.
I feel like that's the meanest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah, I didn't know something mean could come out of you.
This is the first time I've ever said that out loud to people. So, you know,
that's funny.
I think that is pretty an indicator of
you can release
free of self acceptance has been reached today.
Well, I did want to say, Candace brought up this story about like the woman yelling at her in the car, as if this is a new like light bulb experience of meta or like a new
love.
But like on our mission, people would yell at us and like cat call us or be mean to us, and she would be like, "I love you. Jesus loves you."
Yes. All right. Well, we're kind of reaching our time, so I just want one more quick comment about your emphasis to find compassion when you don't hit one of those four markers or whatever, you know, something unskillful, you know, not loving, whatever. We don't want to condition the very thing we're trying to unwind, right? We are trying to condition a compassionate response. And so, yeah, every time we fall down, we get to practice that compassionate response. We get to practice that metta. So yeah, rather than double down, take a moment to practice. Anyway, thank you both for the lovely discussion.
Thank you for listening. As you go about your week, I invite you to open to some of the frames you have operating. When you go to the store, are you looking at everything in terms of I like or need that, or I don't like or need that? Can you catch yourself in the comparing mind? Either comparing others or maybe even yourself? Are you looking at everything you don't have? Or are you looking at all the many things you do have in your life, giving you an opportunity to be grateful? Are you in an abundancy mindset, or are you in a scarcity mindset? Are you happy of others' success, or are you jealous of them? Just keep an eye out for what lenses you're wearing or what frames you're using to build your model of the world. And I'll see you all next week.